Welcome to NFP's Insights from the Experts podcast. Each episode showcases timely expertise and perspective from members of the NFP community, delivering information, analysis, and solutions that address our clients' most significant challenges.
Hello and welcome to the Benefits Compliance Podcast. My name is Suzanne Spradley and I'm here with my colleague Chase Cannon. We're attorneys with NFP and we bring issues to you that have to do with employee benefits programs. And today we're going to focus on some employer mandate IRS rules that employers need to keep in mind. And I know you say employer mandate, that's a little bit old school, but we need to keep some of these items in mind and some really good clarification around an important item that we get lots of questions on. So let's start with just an overview, Chase.
Yeah, thanks, Suzanne. Great to be back on the podcast. And thanks, everybody, for joining. As background, applicable large employers, when we say that term, that's ALE. You may hear that. That's the acronym. We love acronyms. ALEs are employers with 50 or more full-time employees. That includes full-time equivalent employees. So you do need to include your part-time count there in the prior calendar year. And those ALEs have to comply with what we refer to as Section 6055 and 6056 reporting. And that is really all related to what we call the employer mandate, which is the obligation for these employers to offer coverage to their full-time employees and make sure it's affordable, and then report on it. So there's all sorts of obligations tied up in here. And we're going to talk about a couple of deadlines. One of those has actually already gone by. So we're going to re-highlight that here, but then the other deadlines are upcoming and we wanted to re-highlight those. The first deadline is that ALEs must complete and distribute Form 1095C. So there's the dreaded IRS form that employers have come to, I guess we're used to it at this point, but that is the form used to report on employer mandate obligations. And that form has to be distributed to full-time employees by March 1st, 2024. So we're just past that deadline now. That form really includes details regarding whether that employee was offered minimum value affordable coverage during 2023. So we're really on a calendar year basis here. Importantly for that distribution, those forms can be mailed, electronically delivered, or delivered by hand. But we need some proof of delivery in some manner is recommended, particularly for that delivery by hand. Most employers are just sending this out by mail. There is a special rule for electronic delivery, and we always like to highlight that. Anytime you want to send something electronically by email, usually is what that means, or through an app if we're being a little bit more tech forward. But in this context, the employee has to affirmatively consent to delivery of the form in those electronic means. And the consent to receive that Form 1095C in an email or through an app or otherwise electronically has to be given in a manner that reasonably demonstrates that the employee is able to access the statement in that electronic format. So they could also give that consent in a paper document and then confirm it electronically. So you don't have to remember all those little rules, but just that idea that if you have sent this form to employees or if you're going to send it, if you're a little late here, make sure that you've checked the box on those additional requirements for this specific 1095C. The other part of this is for self-insured employers, for ALEs, the bigger self-insured employers, they have to complete Section 3 of Form 1095C. This is the 6055 reporting requirement, and that details which months the employee and any spouse or dependent is that's covered under the plan is reported there. So most self-insured employers that are large will satisfy this reporting requirement on Form 1095C as well. They're already completing that under the employer mandate, so you just finish part three, make sure that gets out. And then, but for self-insured employers that have fewer than 50 full-time employees, you should be doing that via Form 1095B. And so a little bit different form there. And we do know of some smaller self-insured, particularly those with level funded products, that might be considered self-insured, they have to complete that requirement. The one upcoming deadline that we wanted to note here is that employers must also file these forms with the IRS. So that's the other part of the requirement here. For paper filings, that deadline has passed as well. That's February 28th of this year. But electronic filings, which is where almost all employers are going to fall now with a new rule, That needs to be filed by April 1st, 2024. So that is a change this year that we wanted to highlight. Beginning this year, in other words, filings that are occurring in 2024, reporting on 2023, employers that file 10 or more returns of any type have to do so electronically. And that is a combined count that includes 1095s and W-2s as well. So really, most employers are going to have to go to the electronic filing here, and that is something that's different. And that deadline, again, is April 1st, 2024 for filing with the IRS.
All right. So I just want to put in a point of clarification, because this will impact some employers. When we are speaking to the IRS, we're speaking to only the federal rules, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a specific rule for the IRS, and it relates to, you know, we mentioned those forms and those sections of reporting. Those are all IRS code and IRS forms. So yes, it's the IRS that's running the show on these. And but that said, employers with employees located in states with individual mandates may also have to comply with state reporting requirements and should be aware of those applicable deadlines. So some states, this is kind of a result of some states enacting their own individual mandates when the federal ACA individual mandate went away several years back. So most of those state requirements are just to file a 1095C with the state. But some states have very specific rules on how to do that. A few have maybe their own form or their own way of doing that. Most of them also require distribution to the employee, but say if you already distributed under the federal requirement, you're okay here under the state requirement. But it's just one more complexity for multi-state employers to track this. If you do, if you are working with NFP, we do have a publication on this that we can share with you that has all of these state reporting requirements that relate to an individual mandate. So reach out to your NFP advisor for that publication.
Okay, Chase. So staying generally, as it relates to at least individual mandates now at the federal level, we know that HHS, another acronym, which is the Department of Health and Human Services, recently published some numbers that would impact the IRS rules. So can you walk us through what those numbers are and how they come into play here?
Yeah. So back in mid-January, just a couple of weeks ago, HHS released its annual update of the HHS poverty guidelines for 2024. So some employers might read that and think, well, I'm not really interested in this, or it might not apply to my group health plan. But this notice provides an annual update on poverty guidelines. And those guidelines are based on the prior calendar year's increase in prices as measured by the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. These guidelines are used to help determine eligibility for federal programs like Medicaid and to determine eligibility for subsidies in the individual health insurance marketplace. They also impact employers who use the federal poverty line safe harbor when they're performing their ACA employer mandate affordability calculations. And that's really the biggest tie-in here. So the FPL safe harbor, that's the affordability safe harbor under the employer mandate, that uses the FPL, I'm going to use that acronym because it's a little easier to say, FPL, federal poverty line, for a one-person household, and that relates to the respective geographic location, and then you multiply that by the affordability threshold for the respective year, and then you have to divide that by 12. So that's really the calculation. We don't have to remember all those details, but for plan years beginning between January and June of a calendar year, employers can rely on the prior calendar year's FPL for the FPL safe harbor calculation, since the annual update generally occurs after the plan year has already begun. But employers will want to be aware of the new 2024 FPL. And so for 2024, for a one-person household in the 48 contiguous states and DC, that's $15,060. And so that guideline increases by $5,380 for each additional household member. And then there's a different level. I won't go into the numbers for Alaska, but if you're in Alaska or Hawaii, know that your numbers are a little bit different. But if you look at the FPL line for the 48 contiguous states, the maximum, and you go through the calculation that I just walked through with the numbers, the maximum self-only monthly cost share should not exceed $105.29 for employees that are being measured under that FPL safe harbor. So that gives the employer kind of a baseline to run the FPL safe harbor. They can look at the employee contribution and know that it can't exceed that amount every month if the employer wants to meet that FPL safe harbor for affordability. So employers really need to be aware of this for this 2024 update. Again, you can continue to rely on the 2023 guidelines through June of 2024, if that's easier, but eventually you do have to recalibrate for these changing numbers. And once again, we do have an NFP resource on this that outlines these numbers and the affordability, the concept and the calculation relating to affordability generally. So reach out to your NFP advisor on that as well.
So if we if from an employer's perspective, if they are not compliant with affordability as it pertains to their coverage, walk me through what the penalties are that relate to noncompliance.
Yeah, this is a great question. And this is another reason this matters. If you miss that affordability, it's possible you're subject to an employer mandate penalty. And that is triggered if employees go to the exchange and qualify for a premium tax credit. So we really have two penalties there. If you miss on affordability, we would call that penalty B, which is a slightly lower penalty that is applicable only to the actual number of employees that do that, that go to the exchange and qualify for a premium tax credit. Whereas penalty A comes into play if you miss, if you don't offer coverage to at least 95% of your full-time employees, that's a bigger penalty, penalty A, that applies if only one of your employees goes to the exchange and qualifies for a premium tax credit, and you owe that penalty for all of your full-time employees minus 30. You get this little 30 employee reduction, which I have never really understood where that came from, but it is a nice little break, I guess, if you do get this penalty. So each year, those penalty amounts are adjusted, and that comes out through the IRS. They release what we call a revenue procedure, which is just a fancy name for a notice that comes out. So for plan years beginning on or after January 1, 2025, those penalties are for penalty A. And again, this is if you fail to offer minimum essential coverage to at least 95% of all full-time employees and their dependents. That penalty amount is $2,900. That's what it has been, and it's going up to $2,970 for 2024. So again, that's penalty A. Penalty B, the penalty amount was $4,350. That's $4,350 is now going to be $4,460. So if you were an employer that either hasn't offered coverage in the past or has maybe chosen to make coverage unaffordable and risk these penalties, just know that your risk has gone up slightly, and it probably will each year. The way these penalty amounts are adjusted. So again, it re-highlights that importance of making sure if you don't want that risk, making sure that you're offering minimum essential coverage that meets minimum value and affordability to all of your full-time employees. We've seen the IRS continue to enforce this through what we call and what the IRS calls a letter 226J letter. Again, I have no idea where they get the J's and the numbers, but this is basically just a letter to the employer saying, from the IRS, an I love you letter saying you probably owe a penalty here and we're going to engage in a conversation. The employer does have an opportunity to respond to that letter before, before penalties are actually assessed and go through that conversation to show the IRS that they actually did meet their obligations. And you just want to avoid that letter altogether, right? And if you can, the best way to do that is just to make sure you're offering coverage, make sure it's affordable, make sure it's being offered to all full-time employees and their dependents.
So, Jason, and again, we have another publication for that. That's the employer mandate penalties and affordability. You can get from your broker. It feels like that employer mandate topic was one that we had definitely covered in the past, and it was coming back again for us. But it's always important to reiterate because we continually hear of employers getting themselves sideways in that respect. But I want to move on because there's a really important IRS notice that came out. And I say important because this is an area that we continue to see all these various wellness programs that are looking to provide some tax advantages. Some of them work, some of them don't work. And so there was a recent IRS notice or alert that came out that related to what expenses might constitute medical care for FSAs, HSA, and HRA reimbursement. So could you really walk us through that?
Yeah, this is really interesting because, you know, we don't often get like an IRS alert with an exclamation point and something like this. Usually they're much more formal by putting something out through a formal notice. And then they also released a set of FAQs on this. And so, but basically this was just last week, March 6th, 2024. And the alert was meant to remind taxpayers, which in this case would be employers and also individual employees, because you mentioned HSAs, right? That's something that the employee would have to defend if they took a distribution from an HSA and wanted to do it tax-free. They need to make sure that it's medical care. But basically this alert is meant to remind employers or individual employees and administrators that personal expenses for general health and wellness are not considered medical care. And so just as to back up a little bit, there's a code section in the IRS code that is called section 213D, D is the subsection, that describes this idea that a medical care expense can be either reimbursed tax-free or be paid by an individual and deducted as a tax deduction if it constitutes medical care. And so as part of that allowance from the IRS, there's also been subsequent guidance describing, well, what do you mean by medical care? What are medical expenses? And this is sort of a constant battle that the IRS has with people out there and taxpayers out there is what constitutes medical care. And so the general definition is very broad, and that's part of the issue. But I'll just read this definition really quickly. A medical expense is the cost of diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease, and for the purpose of affecting any part or function of the body. So that's kind of the definition that everybody's been working from, which again is very
pretty broad, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, any part, any function of the body, and diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention. That's a lot of stuff that could fall under there, right? And so, but there's a little bit further clarification that says that the medical expenses have to be primarily to alleviate or prevent a physical or mental disability or illness, and they exclude expenses that are merely beneficial to general health. And that's where we're kind of in the gray area. The IRS alert here explains that some companies, and we won't point to anybody, they didn't name anybody here, but we see a lot of these vendors out there now pushing their programs. But basically, there are some companies out there misrepresenting the circumstances under which food, and they use like something for weight loss as an example, and wellness expenses can be paid or reimbursed under these spending arrangements.
And wellness expenses are typically more of what we see.
Right, yeah. So the alert says that these companies erroneously advertise that, for example, a doctor's note based merely on self-reported health information can convert non-medical food, wellness, and food, wellness, and exercise expenses into qualified medical expenses. Then the IRS goes on to clarify that a doctor's note does not satisfy the requirement that it be related to a targeted diagnosis-specific activity or treatment, and that these types of personal expenses don't qualify as medical expenses. And so the IRS in this alert reminds administrators and plans that to pay for reimbursed non-medical expenses can potentially disqualify the plan. And so there's a set of IRS FAQs that are helpful to go out and review here that is part of this notice and alert. And so just that really recent reminder from the IRS to double check your processes and procedures if you're administering a plan, if you're communicating it to employees, which is often where the employer sits with an FSA or an HRA or an HSA, make sure that your communications now include some type of, you know, caution sign or red flag. Hey, double check with these FAQs to make sure that you're not reimbursing something that could be considered non-medical care, something that is general in nature. That's another area where we see, you know, there isn't really a doctor or a licensed professional giving the advice. That's another area where we often see the reimbursement trying to be tax-free, and that's just not how it's supposed to be, according to the IRS.
Sounds good. So Chase, again, I think we've got a great resource on the medical expenses as defined in Section 213D. So if you'll ask your broker for a copy of our publication that's called Qualified Medical Expense and Quick Reference Chart, HSAs, health FSAs, and traditional HRAs, then you'll have a great resource that'll help walk through some of this. So any last thoughts, Chase?
Just a reminder on all these to double check your processes and procedures and make sure you're following these rules. We know the IRS can be brutal at times, and it's never fun to get caught up in that process of having to defend yourself against the IRS. So make sure you're filing the forms that we talked about with 1094 and 1095C. You're distributing to your employees. You're thinking about the employer mandate offers and affordability calculations. And then this last note for any spending accounts that may be out there, spending arrangements that you have with your employees, visiting with the TPA if they're involved or in any employee communications, really highlighting this idea of what it means to be a medical expense, and then pointing to those IRS resources, because that's ultimately the best source here, right? If the IRS says one thing and it's published and it's out there, that's really good guidance to rely on. So lots to consider. We feel the hurt that employers feel on this. We're helping employers all over the place to comply, but some really good stuff here, and hopefully it's helpful to you as you administer and work through the issues with your own plans.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Chase. And as we like to say, that's a wrap.
That's a wrap.
Thank you for joining us today.